Today, the World Health Organization, Donald Trump, and the COVID-19 crisis. Under attack about his handling of COVID-19, with deaths mounting in the US, Donald Trump has hit out in a different direction. He's pointed the finger of blame at the World Health Organization.
They seem to be very China-centric, and we're going to put a hold on money spent to the WHO.
An international body that is charged with coordinating the response of 194 countries to global health crises.
We have a simple message for all countries. Test, test, test.
WHO has a mixed history, with praise for its leadership during the SARS outbreak of 2003 and criticism over its shortcomings with Ebola in 2014. Has it failed in 2020, as Donald Trump suggests? Or has it become a pawn in a struggle between the two largest superpowers in the world? From The Guardian, I'm Anushka Astana. Today in Focus, the World Health Organization under attack.
The struggle against epidemics is a global one, for the danger of death is worldwide. Then, what is the answer?
The World Health Organization was set up in the late 1940s, and it's part of this much larger ecosystem, sort of constellation of international organizations. This is the time that the UN was being formed, and the WHO is actually the first UN body to ever be formed.
Stephen Baranyi is a writer for The Guardian.
And it's part of this very idealistic push to think that you can sort of take on these global problems at a global level through collaboration.
The prime objective of the World Health Organization is the fight against disease on a global scale.
And what did it do in its first years? Did it have early successes?
It's got early failures and early successes. So one thing that it jumped into quite strongly, quite quickly, quite early, was purely the eradication of disease. Because at the time, you know, malaria is a huge problem, cholera, smallpox is a huge problem. They figured that the best thing you could do with an organization that had the power to organize across the entire world was to actually eradicate these diseases, stamp them out wherever they were. And so there was an attempt to eradicate malaria forever, which didn't work largely because the technology wasn't available. But then in the late 1950s, they pivot towards smallpox. I mean, this is something that people at the agency, at the organization, still like to talk about. You know, the first human disease to ever be eradicated. The way they did this was unique to the way that WHO worked, which is that it's not really an operational organization, right? Like, it doesn't send in tens of thousands of doctors and deal with things on the ground. It worked a lot like the UN. This was during the Cold War. And so one of the things they did was, when the Soviet Union returned to the UN General Assembly in the 1950s, they said, basically, do you want to make a good impression on the world, be part of the world community, help us eradicate smallpox? So the Soviet Union said yes. They dedicate some factories to producing vaccines. Later on, the US sees this, and they say, well, you know, we're not going to let the Soviet Union take all the credit for this. And so they start up their own smallpox eradication program. And I mean, smallpox to this day is probably one of the greatest public health campaigns ever.
That's the WHO's history, but it's really established in the 1990s as the institution that we recognise today. And in late 2002, it's hit with a major disease outbreak.
People often say that SARS is sort of the first modern pandemic because it's the first one that travels sort of at the speed of this sort of late 90s, early 2000s globalization, with people just whipping around the world very quickly, and it's sort of tracked at the speed of the internet.
This week saw the galloping rise of SARS, severe acute respiratory syndrome. And as new cases emerge, quarantines expand, and the disease spreads to North America, the consequences...
But it actually starts in a pretty rustic setting. So a farmer in Guangdong province in China is believed to be the first person to ever get SARS. Somewhere between that farmer and the outbreak, somebody in Guangdong province gets it and checks into the Metropole Hotel in Hong Kong. And this is where you get this idea of like a super spreader event. So this businessman at this hotel essentially infects a huge number of people. The Metropole is a hotel that services business people. And sort of before anybody really knows what's happening, you've got cases spreading all over China, all over Hong Kong, and then on to the world. And then basically around this time is when the WHO gets involved.
WHO had to be responsible and take action. As a government leader, you have to do that. You have to take decisions, even if they are difficult and people are opposing them.
The WHO at this time is under the command of Dr. Gro Harlem Brundtland, who's this sort of incredibly powerful, dynamic woman who was the prime minister of Norway. And one of the things that they were doing even before SARS was looking at the entire global landscape and saying, well, look, there's this ability of diseases to travel quite fast now. Also, with technologies like the internet, telecommunications, we should be able to track diseases much faster. And so something that they were doing even before SARS was setting up these sort of surveillance networks where they would track foreign news, track foreign medical message boards, places where scientists, doctors congregate and share information.
Every day at 9 a.m., the WHO's top disease detectives meet in this building. Their work is so sensitive, they wouldn't let us film inside their room. But they gave us this videotape. Their job is to verify outbreaks. Any report, even a rumor, has to be tracked down because they know inaction costs lives.
So even though they're not on the ground, they're all the way in Geneva, they've got this ability to sort of see what's going on. And so what happens during SARS is that before anybody in Guangdong, before anybody in Hong Kong reports anything to the WHO, they're seeing this chatter happening. And it says there is an unknown influenza outbreak. And so they begin to get sort of worried about it.
I was called by one of the key people in my office. So I came into the office that evening and had our first meeting going through everything that the professionals had been gathering across the world.
And then one of the breakpoints is that David Heyman, who ends up being the doctor who coordinates the SARS response, he receives an email from somebody connected to a WHO employee who says, you know, there are several people dead from this novel infection. It's not influenza. We don't know what it is. They're hunched that this is a very serious outbreak, and they take it to the Chinese government. On the same day, 10th of February, 2003, the Chinese government announces to the world, to the WHO, there is an outbreak in Guangdong.
Just before we move on, tell me a bit more about Brundtland and how she ran the organization.
Yeah, I mean, Brundtland's very interesting. And I think it's almost unfair to compare every other director general to her. She was a prime minister, she was a doctor, and she really envisioned the WHO taking a much more proactive role. She was a person who expected to be listened to, was used to taking executive power. And you really see that come through in her leadership of the WHO.
So given that, what did she do when she knew that a deadly disease was spreading, but China wasn't being fully transparent about it?
Brundtland did something that hasn't been done by Director General since, which was she went on the news, she went on to the press, and she basically said, what are you doing? You know, you're not cooperating with us. You're making this worse. If you don't comply, this is going to get much worse and it's all going to be on you.
We must take the precautionary measures now. It is now we have a chance to contain it, and you have to use public health tools to do so.
The WHO, for the first time, recommended that people not travel to certain areas.
And within 4 months, we were able to contain the whole disease. It had spread to 15 or 20 different places. But by containing each one with quite tough measures, every single epidemic was stopped. And meanwhile, after a month, our scientists across the world had identified what this new virus was, a coronavirus that we named SARS.
It sounds like what she did was she basically gave teeth to an organization that didn't actually have them.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's all about what you believe, right? I mean, she went in and she acted like the WHO was a big, powerful organization, like it could get things done, like it could, you know, punish you if you didn't comply just by acting that way, just by making it happen.
Due to an unprecedented global collaboration in public health, the World Health Organization can say that the SARS outbreaks have been contained worldwide.
I mean, SARS is considered like the golden example for containing a modern pandemic. So you've got this disease that is fairly transmissible. It's super, super deadly. And it was held to under 10,000 cases confirmed worldwide, under 1,000 deaths. And I think the thing to remember about all this stuff is that, like coronavirus now, I mean, the thing that's so scary about SARS and about COVID is there are no treatments, there are no cures. But it basically means that, you know, you have to use policy, you have to use social distancing, you have to use quarantine to take these things on because there is no medicine.
Okay, so in a pretty strong position as it continued through the noughties, what happened next?
You could maybe say the major thing that happened is that Brundtland stepped down. Her major successor was Dr. Margaret Chan.
This is a moment of great personal honor for me.
Who's a Canadian Chinese physician. She was in the Hong Kong public health departments during SARS. She was seen as like somebody who could definitely carry on this legacy of dealing with pandemics.
I do not take this responsibility lightly.
But then over the decade from about 2009 until now, you see this very slow sort of almost loss of institutional confidence from the WHO.
In late April, WHO announced the emergence of a novel influenza A virus.
The first pandemic after SARS is this 2009 swine flu.
Has not circulated previously in humans.
This is a situation in which the WHO announced a public health emergency. They announced the pandemic. Countries responded. They stockpiled flu medications. They stockpiled vaccines. Death toll kept quite low. But in the immediate aftermath, these questions arise about whether the WHO basically called this too early, whether they cried wolf. The media condemnation of this was really, really strong. And there were inquiries. And I think you see the entire leadership starting to get, I guess, a bit rattled about the confidence to make these sort of calls. And this sort of reaches the other extreme and perhaps like the nadir of the organization during Ebola in 2014. Outbreak
in four West African nations, Guinea, Sierra Leone, Liberia, and Nigeria, rose today to at least 932. To remind you, Ebola is spread not through the air, but through contact with bodily fluids, including sweat, saliva, and blood.
Tell me what happened.
In 2014, there was an Ebola outbreak in Guinea. And when they reported it, there were 49 cases and 29 deaths, which is already pretty significant. Liberia and Sierra Leone reported cases shortly afterwards. And the WHO sent scientists and doctors to observe. And then, for reasons that are still sort of unclear, as the outbreak got worse and worse, months later with 1,500 people dead, the WHO didn't declare a public health emergency until the 7th August, so nearly 5 months later. And so basically that means that it declined to coordinate a response from the rest of the world, call for support from its member states, travel recommendations, all the stuff that basically, you know, it pioneered as its toolkit during SARS. It allowed the outbreak to spiral completely out of control. It deteriorated to the point that the U.S. sent troops in to support. A U.N. committee was created to take responsibility away from the WHO. And condemnation on the slowness, the tentativeness of their response was deafening.
More than 6 months after the Ebola outbreak began in West Africa, the global response is in the spotlight. A memo from the World Health Organization leaked last month suggested incompetent staff and a lack of information hampered efforts to stop the disease from spreading. Questioned on the issue Wednesday, WHO Director General Margaret Chan acknowledged there were problems.
Really a huge low point. I think there were six different inquiries into what went wrong. Just a massive screw up.
I mean, if there were six different inquiries, how come we still don't really understand it? And what role did Dr. Margaret Chan play?
The Director General holds a lot of power over the WHO. I'm not sure whether the condemnation of Chan is sort of fair or unfair. She was somebody, people have told me, who very much took a background role. She told people that she wasn't super proactive. She didn't want to call anybody out. Chan described being director general in an interview as a job where you have 194 bosses. But many countries behave like a visitor to the WHO, not a shareholder. I don't want to micromanage, she said. What makes me unhappy is that my bosses, they promise and talk, but then they don't walk the walk. That is the problem. I think that really shows that whoever leads the WHO can take a totally different course with it, with the exact same organization, because it's almost impossible to imagine Brundtland saying the same thing. I mean, I don't think she saw herself as subservient to the member states, as serving them so much as working with them.
what you're saying is that who's at the top of the World Health Organization is critical. It's the difference between whether it's effective or not during a health emergency. The members last elected a leader in 2017. China is said to have lobbied for Tedros, and the US is reported to have nominally backed his opponent.
On the nomination of the executive board, appoints Dr. Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus as Director General of the World Health Organization.
Tell us about the man who took over the WHO after a pretty difficult period for the organisation and who would lead it into this COVID-19 crisis.
Sure. Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus is an Ethiopian malaria researcher. He is the first who's not a medical doctor. He wasn't really brought in to save the WHO.
I have the passion, hands-on experience, technical expertise, political leadership, and diplomatic skills to lead WHO for the 21st century.
I mean, his election was really contentious. He was up against Dr. Nabarro from the UK, who was sort of the favorite of the traditional powers in the WHO. I mean, he's seen as somebody who is very comfortable with the politics of the organization. In those press conferences, he always seems to be sort of on top of everything. I think that nobody expected him to be 1A in a crisis. I think he was seen as a sort of a safe pair of hands to bring everybody forward.
And tell me about the immediate response to COVID-19. How was the WHO notified and what did it do?
So the WHO was notified of an outbreak of, again, unknown pneumonia, again, in China, on the 31st of December 2019. I mean, the response at the time is that essentially they're just supposed to hold the government to reporting information. And so they want to know what the virus is, who's infected, where are they, are the cases being tracked? And then if they need to, they'll send in observers to evaluate the situation on the ground.
And how does China respond to that?
The Chinese government refuses to let a WHO-led team into Wuhan. They basically close up shop. People will tell you this is sort of the default response of the Chinese government in crisis. Shut down information, get control of the situation. But the problem is, you know, this is an epidemic, possibly a pandemic. The rest of the world needs to know what's going on. And so the WHO is blind except for what the Chinese government is reporting to them. Tedros requests a meeting with Xi Jinping, which he holds in the last week of January. And throughout that entire time, the WHO and Tedros specifically are very careful to praise China.
Very impressive and beyond words. So is China's commitment to transparency.
You know, Tedros is saying the Chinese government is doing a great job. And so he has this private meeting. And then a week later, China agrees to let WHO observers in.
In many ways, China is actually setting a new standard for outbreak response. And it's not an exaggeration.
So the WHO do get in on February the 8th, but what was that strategy by Tedros? I mean, presumably that's quite different than we might have seen from Brundtland.
Yeah, I mean, it definitely is. I mean, and they'll tell you in the press conferences that the way that the WHO works now is that they don't criticize their member states. I mean, I think there's quite an interesting split depending on whether you're sort of thinking idealistically or you're thinking really operationally. So lots of politicians, journalists, etc. have been very critical of the WHO, you know, saying, you know, why aren't you calling out China? Why aren't you holding them to account? Whereas you see a lot of people in public health saying, look, we don't have any power. You basically have to keep your allies on side. And so, you know, in an ideal world, the WHO would tell China, you know, you shouldn't have done that. Let us in. And they would do it. It's what Brundtland did. But the world is very different now. The WHO is very different now. And it just seems like we're at a point that institutionally they're not willing to do that.
Okay, so that's happening with China. Meanwhile, what else are they doing?
They have to decide whether they're going to declare a public health emergency of international concern. And this is sort of the thing that engages all their member states to listen to them, to take care of the crisis. And so towards the end of January, they convene this committee. It actually meets twice. So it meets once with China, Japan, Thailand, and the WHO, so affected countries. And they decline to call a public health emergency at that time. And they don't actually call it till about a week later, on the 27th of January. So they're basically seeing that their member states are not preparing in the way that they'd like. So this is where Tedros is coming out, and he's saying, you know, this is the mantra. You know, you test, and we can get a handle on this. And yet across the world, you're basically seeing that their member states are not doing this.
So what do they do?
So basically by March 11th,
COVID-19 can be characterized as a pandemic.
This escalation, you'll see in this press conference between March 11th and March 13th, when they call it, they're calling out countries not by name, but just in general terms, basically saying the time right now is to contain the virus, not to mitigate it. And they're basically trying to get Western countries to do something about it.
Are there particular countries that they're pointing to?
Yeah, I mean, when they say the time for containment is now, they're widely thought to be talking to the UK and the US, who are particularly slow in instituting social distancing and especially in getting the testing regime going.
And since then, we've seen something pretty extraordinary from US President Donald Trump. He has lashed out at the World Health Organization, culminating last week in a threat to freeze US funding.
Today, I'm instructing my administration to halt funding of the World Health Organization while a review is conducted to assess the World Health Organization's role in severely mismanaging and covering up the spread of the coronavirus.
I mean, that's potentially hundreds of millions of pounds. And he issued the threat on World Health Day, that's meant to be the day we celebrate the founding of the WHO. Why? What is his charge sheet against the organization? And does it stack up?
Yeah, I mean, Trump accused the WHO of severely mismanaging and covering up the spread of coronavirus. And the charge that I think he wants to make stick is that by coddling China, by going easy on them, he wants us to say that they allowed the virus to spread out of control and that sort of we wouldn't see this emergency if it weren't for that.
The WHO failed to investigate credible reports from sources in Wuhan that conflicted directly with the Chinese government's official accounts.
But I mean, if you go back, there are definitely legitimate concerns about how long China took to report, about their compliance in the early stages. At the time that China was cracking down on the virus, doing quarantines, tracking and tracing, basically shutting down Wuhan, Trump himself was praising the Chinese government, praising Xi Jinping, saying they had it under control. And I mean, Trump has also said that the WHO ignored warnings from Taiwan. There are serious questions about the way Taiwan has been treated by the WHO. China has blocked it from joining the organization since the 1970s, as it has with every UN body. But Trump was also specifically saying a warning that Taiwan didn't actually do about human-human contact. And early on, Trump did institute a flight ban from China that the WHO later said wasn't necessary.
Fortunately, I was not convinced and suspended travel from China.
But that seemed to be grandstanding because in reality, the U.S. didn't do anything to prepare for the pandemic throughout the entirety of February, really.
Okay, so why is Trump attacking the WHO and how significant is that threat?
I mean, I think you see him sort of scrambling around for answers because his administration has done a very bad job with this particular emergency. And I mean, none of this stuff is outside of the Trump playbook. He's moved to escalate tensions with China over trade, other diplomatic matters over and over. And also, I mean, he's no friend to international organizations. He's wanted to defund the WHO specifically before.
As the organization's leading sponsor, the United States has a duty to insist on full accountability.
It's hundreds of millions of pounds. The U.S. is the biggest funder of the WHO in the entire world and always has been. So I think you see in an emergency him reaching for this playbook where it's blame China, it's retreat from the international arena, and it's sort of tar everybody with this same brush that you've sort of seen before.
And it's clearly not an empty threat. He's talking about freezing funding straight away. And there's also been action at the G20, where the US appears to have watered down a statement of support for the WHO, according to an exclusive story by our colleague Patrick Winter. If Trump sticks to this, given how much money the US puts in, it could be devastating for the world's poorest countries.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the bulk of the WHO's work is not in pandemic response, right? It's in global public health, and it'll absolutely be hamstrung in its ability to do that if it loses that funding.
And if we finally bring this back to leadership, what does it mean for Tedros and for his time at the WHO?
I think a lot of that has to do with how he continues through this crisis. I mean, he's definitely going to face some extremely hard questions about how he dealt with China, how he dealt with Xi Jinping specifically. But I think it's important to look at exactly what the WHO can and cannot do. I mean, public health officials around the world have been, I think, remarkably generous in their evaluation of the WHO. They basically acknowledge that they can't always tell superpowers what to do. And then when you do these things, like you go back and can say, you know, Brundtland was this kind of leader. She was so strong. She did this and that. You know, Tedros isn't Brundtland, but also, you know, the world of 2020 is not the same as the world of 2003. The WHO of 2020 is not the same as the WHO of 2003. Debbie Sridhar, who's an international public health expert and who has criticized the WHO in the past, especially over its Ebola response, basically says that it's hard to fault a lot of what the WHO has been trying to do because it's a difficult balancing act trying to get countries to both address this epidemic and take it seriously while also trying to keep them all at the table. You're looking at a world with two major superpowers and the U.S. sort of retreating from its traditional role as a world leader. It's a much more fragmented international system. And I mean, I think that you're seeing Tedros having to deal with that in a way that no other director general has. And it's not just Trump with criticism. You know, other world leaders have come forward. Scott Morrison of Australia has been very critical. Shinzo Abe of Japan said, you know, now is not the time, but that there definitely might be some WHO reform needed in the future. It is the case that Tedros is probably facing the greatest challenge in the institution's entire history.
Stephen, thank you very much.
Thank you.
That was Stephen Baranyi, who has written a brilliant long read about all of this. Do look it up at theguardian.com. You can also read our diplomatic editor, Patrick Winter, on the G20, our politics team on how the British government is handling intensifying questions about its own potential failures, and of course, our health and science reporters. There is a rolling live blog, and I do urge you to listen to our other podcasts, Science Weekly and Politics Weekly. That's it for today. This episode was produced by Chika Ayres. Sound design was by Nicholas Cox. The executive producers are Phil Maynard and Nicole Jackson. We'll be back tomorrow.